your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, September 28th, 2025, as we record this show. Well, folks, the 2025 season is over for the White Sox. September was an odd month in which the White Sox started 8-2, then lost 11 of their next 12, and if it wasn't for the bullpen, could have swept the Washington Nationals, but settled for winning the series, winning 2 out of 3. The final record for the White Sox in 2025 is 60 wins and 102 losses, which is a 19-win improvement from last season. In this episode, we recap the White Sox final series, give our assessment of Will Venable's first year as manager, Michael A. Taylor calls it a career, give out our season awards for the White Sox, MVP, best pitcher, and most improved player, and in the end, our postseason predictions that I'm sure will be very wrong. Joining me as Sox Machine's managing editor, Jim Margulis, as James Fegan makes his way back home from Washington, D.C., and I think that's a good way to start, Jim, is once again thanking everyone that followed us on social media, that went to SoxMachine.com daily, read our work, listened to the podcast, watched our videos. Thank you so much for your continued support throughout the 2025 season.
Yes, absolutely. Especially in years like this, as we know, a lot easier to follow and maintain interest in the White Sox when they're actually competitive, even if they're not like contending, you know, playing 70, 75 win ball versus like struggling, needing the last day of the season to get out of the 50 win territory. Really appreciate that people go out of their way to be interested in the White Sox. Certainly appreciate the coverage that James provided on the road. Definitely more enlightening when you have somebody on the scene traveling with the team, getting insights from players and managers, even not off the record, but like in between records, like stuff you hear casually on the side that might make a difference later when you hear about a pitch grip or you hear about somebody making a tweak and you don't know if it's actually going to be a story, but 3 weeks later it comes into play. And then you have that information that you just learned offhand from a side conversation and all comes together. And that's the kind of stuff that you get when you have a reporter traveling with the team. And, you know, when players and coaches see reporters traveling with the team, they think, oh, they're in it with us. We can open up more because they're on the road versus just dropping in when it's convenient for them. So it makes a big difference. You hear a lot from fans saying like, why do you have report? Why are reporters even necessary? All they do is transcribe quotes. We saw that in Bull Durham. Yeah, they just get the most bland quotes to get through a season. And you know, that is true for post game stuff in a way of just, you know, especially after failure, have to clean it up, unacceptable. You know, going to learn from this, etc. But it's the stuff before the games, the stuff around the games that really highlights why having the access is important. I think James proves that every series that he travels with the team, every week, as you see the stuff from his notebook come out. So, yes, thank you immensely to the people who support us and make that possible. And hopefully, you know, as we continue to build our subscribership, which is still growing, you know, and we're not losing people, still growing, that we are able to do more with it and really, you know, give people their money's worth.
And we're going to have lots of off-season content coming your way. So it doesn't stop for us. We're not taking the fall and winter off. We'll be sending James to Las Vegas for the GM meetings, and our plan is for us to be in Orlando again for the MLB winter meetings. So Sox Machine will be active. And of course, we have the off-season plan project coming up. There'll be stuff to do, stuff to talk about for the Chicago White Sox all off-season long. So we do not take a break, but we do want to take a moment to thank everyone for following along with us and watching the White Sox in 2025. It was a lot more fun covering this team, Jim, post 4th of July, I would say, with the MLB draft and getting Billy Carlson and then post All-Star break, the offense suddenly is the 2000 Chicago White Sox. It was a lot more fun, and hopefully that level of play continues into 2026. Now, with the White Sox winning 2 out of 3 against the Washington Nationals, the offense came alive again as the offense really quieted down, especially a tough series against the Yankees and the Padres, and the White Sox didn't put up a lot of runs against the Baltimore Orioles in that 9-game stretch. But they really beat up on Washington Nationals pitching. And there's two moments from this series that I really enjoy, Jim. One, Colson Montgomery having a season highlight with the White Sox blowing that 8-1 lead on Friday night. And they're down 9-8. Colson Montgomery in the ninth inning hitting that go-ahead 2-run homer. I think that's such a cool moment for Colson, Jim, because yes, we're going to have this roller coaster from him. He hasn't displayed amazing on-base skills, but when the game is on the line and you got a runner on first base and you're down by a run and you could really use a home run, I like the fact that Colson Montgomery has become that guy for the White Sox, because that's a question we've had for a while, and who's going to be the big home run hitter, and it appears it's going to be Colson Montgomery.
Yeah, and it looks like, you know, the White Sox did get somebody to beat Adrian Hauser in wins above replacement. He finished with 3 and only 3 point something according to Baseball Reference. We'll see when it's updated for the end of the season. But, you know, in only 71 games played, hitting 21 homers in only 71 games played all after the All-Star break, that's pretty incredible. The short memory, I think, is what's key with him. And that's, I think, the biggest difference between him and his Charlotte form is just the struggles in Charlotte could last for a series, could last, like, I guess their series did last a week, but, like, you know, it'd go from 3 games to 6 games to 2 weeks. And you're watching him and you're thinking, like, where is the action? And, like, when he fell out of the top 100 rankings, that was the best way I could describe it as a non-scout. You know, I couldn't necessarily tell you about, you know, like, load or direction or, you know, any of the finer points of hitting without somebody maybe guiding my vocabulary for me, but I could just watch him and say, like, he's not generating any action. He's not making things happen. If the ball is in a very specific zone, he can do something with it, but his barrel can't beat pitches to a spot. He can't, like, foil a plan. It's just more like taking advantage of the mistake he gets. And if he doesn't do that, then he's kind of screwed. And once he got to the majors, that flipped. And even, you know, he showed enough in the minors to get to the majors. Like, he didn't, you know, his promotion to the White Sox wasn't unearned, but it was a little bit shaky in terms of when he got to the White Sox. You're thinking, like, is he going to be able to stay hot? Is his first cold streak going to ruin him the way that it would ruin him weeks at a time in Charlotte? And the cool thing was, the answer was no. It was, you know, he'd have some ugly games. He'd have some games where he's overmatched. The strikeouts would bunch up on him, but he didn't look ruined by it. He looked like, I'm facing the best pitching in the world. I'm a rookie. This is forgivable versus, my season's going into a tailspin because I had 3 bad games in a row. So at this point, like, you know, watching him hit that homer and watching, like, the power surge happen again, it reminded me of Jake Berger, of just, like, the good point of Jake Berger, which is, you wonder how he's a major leaguer at times, and then you realize, like, oh, he's got as much power as anybody in the game, and it's cool when he gets into one. And he doesn't look bothered by the times he doesn't get into one. It just looks like he's one small tweak or one, you know, one sense of timing away from destroying things. And I think that's the best thing you can say about Colson. Well, I guess the second best thing. First best thing is that he's playing a credible shortstop, which had always been in doubt. So Jake Berger playing shortstop is a pretty valuable player, and, you know, the improvements you get in the on-base percentage in the hit tool are all kind of gravy from here.
Yeah, and again, there's room for improvement, but to your point, according to Baseball Reference, Jim, Colson Montgomery being a 3-WAR shortstop for the White Sox in 71 games is a great sign. More on Montgomery later in the show, but the second thing that I thought was great from this weekend, Shane Smith. He gets the ball on the final day. Not really necessary. He's already had a very good season. Impressive for a Rule 5 pick. Didn't know what to make of him. Maybe he's a reliever. He wins a starting pitching job, and then he becomes the White Sox All-Star. Has a bump in the road mid-season, but boy, in his last 11 starts for the White Sox was terrific and probably enters the 2026 season as the White Sox ace, or at least one of the top 2 pitchers, depending on what the White Sox do this offseason in free agency and trade. But there was a part of me, Jim, I didn't want to jinx Shane Smith on social media, but it was five perfect innings, very efficient innings. And the Nationals finally got a single against Shane Smith in the sixth inning. He went six scoreless innings, only allowed the one hit, no walks, with eight strikeouts on 73 pitches. And there's a part of me, Jim, it's like it's a long off season. And yeah, you want to be careful with Shane because he's had a career high in innings pitched. But man, there's a part of me that's wondering, the way that he was throwing, Jim, he could have had a shutout, a complete game shutout for the White Sox on the final day. He was just terrific, and I think that's also another great sign for the White Sox, just how strong Shane Smith finished this season.
I think if he were going for a no-hitter, you know, Venable would have pitched in the seventh, you know, maybe the eighth if it continued, and he were that efficient. If I think if he had like a 28-pitch inning with two walks, that all of a sudden, you know, shows that the wheels are coming off a little bit or at the risk of doing so, he wouldn't have let him go for the no-hitter, but he was averaging like 15 pitches or fewer than 15 pitches an inning, like 3.8 pitches. That would have been like a 108 pitch complete game if he went nine innings. So like at that pace, sure. Let him keep going and see how far it goes. I have a personal rule when it comes to watching no hitters. I don't get excited until after six and a third because that's what I call the Danny Wright line. The worst until Kyle Freeland came one out short in Colorado. I saw that in person, but before then that was the longest no hit bid I'd seen in person. And it was the worst. So many walks, nobody in the crowd was convinced it could happen. And just everybody's kind of relieved when he finally gave up a hit, like, oh, good. Like, we can stop pretending that this is a thing. And so he came up a full inning short of that. So I wasn't convinced or worried about having to scrap the recap I had been kind of poking at, thinking like, oh, I got to write one for a no-hitter or a perfect game. But yeah, a great finish to a season. One thing that's fascinating about him, I hadn't looked at the StatCast page in a while. If you look at his StatCast page, at the top of his page, they show the percentiles for run values. Fastball run value, 97th percentile, deep red. Breaking run value, breaking ball run value, first percentile, deep blue, the deepest of blue. And you look at that and think like, how is that guy a starter? But then you watch him pitch, you know, since he righted the ship over the last 2 months, and you think like, oh, you know, it makes sense. Like it's working. And you would think that given the simplicity of his approach, just fastball, sinker, and then sprinkling in changeups and curveballs, like you would think that's something easy to scout against. It's just a matter of like, is he executing it? If he is, then hitters got to be able to fight stuff off until they get a mistake. If he's not executing it, maybe a little bit simpler, but he did show the ability to repeat it. And he was in peak form on Sunday, just the way the sinker was running, had the ability to run pitches in on righties, move pitches up. And then, you know, when he needed a curveball, not necessarily the best percentage in terms of locating it, but the mistakes that he made, the misses were good misses, unhittable, like not going to swing at it, but also not going to torch it. And the ones that he executed were all whiffs. So I think that's basically the perfect form of Shane Smith is fastball heavy. And it's different from how he started the season, which the changeup was the pitch everybody's raving about. And now it's cool that even though hitters adjusted to it and that didn't prove to be like, yeah, as hitters adjusted to it and made him change the way he approached hitters, it didn't prove to be like his only trick in the book. He showed a way to evolve. And now it's a case of, well, he crossed that off his list, adjusting to the first adjustment made to him. He threw a full season's worth of appearances, 29 starts and what, nearly 150 innings. So like, that's all good. That's all, you know, that's a huge jump in his previous high. Like he went from 94, I think, to 140 something. So, yeah, there's nothing else you could want from him. And then you forget that he's a Rule 5 pick on top of that. So the White Sox got him for free. And now even if he might not be like the ace of his staff, he looks very much like a number three starter, number four starter on a great staff. And, you know, what more could you want?
So a good series for the White Sox, the bullpen. We have many months ahead of us to talk about the White Sox bullpen. It is a clear need. The White Sox got to find some better arms. And I think we're going to see a big overhaul this offseason. I can't wait to see your guys' offseason plan projects on how you rebuild the White Sox bullpen. I can't imagine the White Sox bringing more than four guys back in their bullpen going into next season. But with the 2025 season over and the White Sox finishing 60-102, and as I mentioned in the intro, that is a 19-win improvement. Jim, what is your initial assessment of the season?
Could have been worse. I think could have been a little bit better. Especially when you look at the Pythagorean record that the White Sox had, like I'm guessing they'll be 71-91 by the time the numbers are updated, but it was 70-91, and they had a 59-win team going to the final day. So that shows that various forms of underachievement, first and foremost, the bullpen, just losing games in late innings, but also like the bullpen being so crucial to a team's success that brings the offense into it, and the offense's ability to tack on runs, or in the first half not tacking on runs, and you have to make a one run lead hold up over four innings after the starter throws 85 pitches over five, and that's not always feasible to ask. So you had like a lot of cases where the bullpen is the big thing, but there are other elements feeding into it that really expose a bullpen for being less than overpowering. So a lot of small things feeding into it. I think you would like to see more players being fixtures going into next season. Like the rotation is largely unsettled aside from Smith and Davis Martin, I think. Sean Burke, probably good. Jonathan Cannon, probably good. But they need at least one. And either Burke or Cannon can be crowded out if they somehow like land somebody else of intrigue. So given the number of young starters that auditioned and the number of starts they got, I think you'd like to see more pitchers winning spots. Same thing with the infield. Miguel Vargas and Lenin Sosa had okay seasons, but not quite enough to say they're our third baseman of the future, or they're the right side of the infield of the future if Sosa's going between first and second. The outfield is largely unsettled, especially like with Luis Robert. Assume he's coming back, but even if he does, in what form? So as well as they played the second half, you would have liked to see a few more answers. But the second half was, I think, a good starting point for launching into the coming off season. I think we saw after 121 losses, what do you even do? What's the point? Should they contract this team? should they simulate to end? Like there was really, it was just a mess, and it allowed them to get Will Venable, and he had some foundational things to address. But given that the whole point of Pedro Grifol was like restoring the foundation, and then after his disappointing season, we're going to really attack the foundation. It was like season three of setting the foundation. So that just is in one ear and out the other, and you just think like, wake me up when it's actually being proven. Now I think like, okay, they're showing it. The effort's there. Some ability to correct course with players over the course of a season is there. So now it seems like the work of roster building can begin, which is not great in Chris Getz's second full season coming up and third year, calendar year on the job. But it's something. It's progress, finally.
Yeah, I still don't know and how I want to look at the White Sox heading to this offseason. Because if the math says that they have a 71-win talent team right now, is that what you're building on from the offseason? Are you still building off a 60-win team? From the comments from Chris Getz, I'm wondering if he's leaning towards the latter, Jim, where he's like, guys, I have a 60-win team that we're still building. We're still far away. I still need another year of rebuilding. But if you listened, podcast listeners, to our episode a couple episodes ago with Brooks Boyer, the chief marketing officer for the White Sox, making it clear you can't rebuild forever. Like, there is a business need for the White Sox to start generating better results in the field to get fans into the stadium because they need money. This is a tough spot for Chris Getz. Like, I think they have a 60-win team. They still need another year rebuilding. But I think also Brooks is right, Jim. The White Sox can't rebuild forever. So I would allow it. I give it a pass if 2026 is another quote-unquote rebuilding year. where the expectations are this team's not going to finish 500, but you have to make another significant jump in wins, 10, 15, maybe even a 20-win improvement next season, because 2027 and beyond, you got to start winning. You got to start taking advantage of all of these rookie contracts that you got for Teal, Caro, Montgomery, Mydroth. This is going to be a pretty cheap core for the White Sox, both on the position player front and the pitching front, Jim. And you want to take advantage of that as well, because that's how you can add big salaries, marquee players, while keeping your team payroll pretty low.
Yeah, it's like the equivalent of like hearing the Bears talk about, or the Bears talk, I should say, around like Caleb Williams on a rookie contract. He's, yeah, you know, as soon as he gets to, you know, out of his rookie years, his salary is going to explode. And then how do you add around that, you know, if they want to keep him? So it's, yeah, a smaller concern, or not as drastic, going from rookie contract to starting quarterback NFL pay.
Yeah.
You get a sliding scale of which you can prepare and decide whether to retain a guy, or in the case of like Andrew Vaughn, his salary went up and like, no, it's not worth it. You know, and then you find your exits from it. But yeah, I think if I'm, I guess the middle ground between Chris Getz's, you know, conservative approach to at least discussing the winter, and then what Brooks Boyer said, is maybe not a rebuilding winter, but a building winter. Okay. Might be the way to say it. You're not going to go all out. I think it's not in Chris Getz's interest to say the money will be spent, or, you know, we're looking to, you know, swim in the deep end. You know, we want a seat at the table. You know, all of the quotes that came back to bite Rick Hahn whether he had the rug pulled out from under him, or whether his mouth was writing checks that he, you know, just figured he might be able to cash later, but had no certainty on whether the White Sox would actually approve a contract of the spending he was talking about. Like, I think it makes sense given that the White Sox had like the September that they had and wobbled at the end, that you can't say, yeah, we're going full speed ahead. You know, perhaps if they finished September like 15, you know, like 15, or was it 14, 11, they finished September versus 11 to 14 and really built on, you had some good showings against winning teams. Maybe you can like spice up the rhetoric a little bit, but the way that they looked overmatched against superior teams, you can still say, you know, we're not quite there yet. Look at our outfield, look at our infield.
Yeah.
We need to solve like six spots. You can't do that in one winter, or you can't talk about doing that one winter. But I would think that you can maybe secretly harbor some greater ambitions, and you can look for good opportunities, especially we don't know what this winter is going to look like with the lockout, which, you know, we probably know a lockout's going to happen, whether it costs like games in the 2027 season. Hard to know given the TV deal that the league has to strike. You know, they're trying to move towards this, you know, package with local broadcasts along with national broadcasts. And I don't think they can afford to nuke their national fan base with half season missed games, in kill ratings. So like, with that happening, like Root Sports, Seattle dissolving its Root Sports situation and realizing like, oh, the league is really going to be beefing up its local programming. All of a sudden I'm more optimistic for 2027 in terms of getting a full slate of games in. So I'm not quite sure what this winter is going to bring in terms of spending, but there could be some interesting opportunities to add a good player on a reasonable salary that helps out the position of need. Like if they get like a guy in a $17 million contract, like do the White Sox take that shot? Say, what does our outfield look like with a good right fielder? Or what does our infield look like with a real good second baseman or something like that? And see how it goes. I could see that making sense. You mentioned the, you know, needing to bring in more revenue. They also need to make their team better for like figuring out their next stadium deal. They need to draw more fans to make themselves, to drum up more support as a entity worthy of public funds if they go that route. So there's a lot of reasons for the White Sox to generate more excitement with their spending. We'll see what Justin Ishbia's presence means, whether it's just paying down debts and the White Sox keeping the same payroll projections, or whether it means like they can take a swing. I wouldn't mind seeing them take a swing. I still think Chris Getz has to be not careful about it in terms of spending, but careful about it in terms of, you know, what he promises the fan base or what he says it can mean. But I think they have enough interesting young players to where there is some upside they can capture if enough players click, but they also don't want to be out over their skis in the event that, like, yeah, Miguel Vargas isn't really a guy. Colson takes a step back because of his just his plate approach needs fine-tuning. We have no outfielders because Luis Robert Jr. got hurt again. There are some, yeah, I think the scenarios for this team are going to be pretty wide-ranging in terms of like what their 80th percentile is and what their 20th is. And so I think it makes sense for Getz to have some guardrails with regards to both his enthusiasm and his pessimism.
What is your thought on Will Venable's first season as White Sox manager?
Good. Definitely an improvement in this case where, like, he had a 121 loss manager. Grifol was not on hand for all the losses that the White Sox had in 2024, but he was very much like a 121 loss manager for just the respect that he seemed to generate, the amount of times he needed to stick his foot in his mouth, just the lack of problem solving. Like, he failed on all fronts as a manager. Might have been a decent person, but never presented himself as a person. He presented himself as 100% baseball, and the baseball was terrible. So, very poor bet by him on that front. But Venable, like, I, there's some room for improvements, I think, especially with the bullpen. And it's not so much that he mismanaged the bullpen. It's a case where either he didn't manage the bullpen well, or the bullpen was so far beyond like a formula that he just had to try to protect a lead an inning at a time. And as we saw during this national series, be a case where, okay, you've used your best relievers, now you need Steven Wilson in high leverage, even though, like, if he had everything lined up the way you want it to, it'd be Jordan Leisure and Grant Taylor being like the eighth and ninth inning guys. But sometimes you have to use them earlier. And in the case of Venable, he thought he had to use them earlier, and then he ran out of like high leverage guys. And then you're trying to hope that Brandon Isert and Steven Wilson and whoever can cover those innings. So on one hand, I don't mind that necessarily in terms of trying to take some of the importance or air out of the idea of the closer role and it being so vital to a team success that if you don't have everything lined up on a given day, you're really flying by the seat of your pants and you're going to have players panicking or feeling like, you can't solve this problem. So I don't mind that. But when the White Sox go into their second year with Venable in charge, like, I think that's when we're looking forward to the most, is figuring out, like, what's his bullpen approach? And if he had enough arms to where he has at least three high leverage arms, how does he use them? Does he believe in a true closer? Does he believe in, how much does he believe in matchups versus trying to preserve the lead as late as possible and lock in sure victories? We didn't really get to see that at all. That's a pretty big question mark, because that is, I think, the biggest part of a manager's tactics. You say a lot about, lineups and a lot about bunting and playing for one run versus, trying to maximize your ace swings in a game. But game to game, series to series, I think bullpen management is the biggest difference a manager can make, and we didn't really learn anything about that. Or if we did learn about it, it's a case of where, like, yeah, it's unique, and not in a good way. But I think we need to give him a year, given just how in flux that unit was. Otherwise, I think he hit the marks in terms of admitting the occasional mistake when he made a mistake, which is something Grifol really struggled with. He had a pretty, ca yeah, I would say casual, comfortable approach with the media, even after bad games. Kept an even tone,
That's true.
admonished mistakes when they happened, but didn't really throw anybody under the bus. Didn't get a sense of panic. A lot more secure than Grifol was in terms of presenting himself to the media and sounding like he'd seen things before. Sounded like when it came to information and the flow of information to players and defensive alignments and game plans, everything like that, that sounded a lot more either robust or free-flowing. Nobody sounded, I can't remember many occasions where you heard about like a bad scouting reports, where you heard about players being positioned poorly. Seemed like the information flow was superior and closer to that of a winning ball club or a winning organization. So Big picture, I think he's a good guy had at the helm of the dugouts. As expectations grow, we saw that with Renteria. We saw that with, going back to like my formative years as somebody starting to understand the game, like Jerry Manuel. You learn more about a manager when winning games actually matters, and like when winning a specific game looms large. But for this foundational step of building just a credibility as a manager, I think he did pretty well.
Prior to the 2025 season finale, Michael A. Taylor told our James Fegan and other White Sox beat reporters that he's retiring. Taylor played 12 seasons in the majors, spanning 1,216 games. He only played with the White Sox in 2025, but spent 7 seasons with the Washington Nationals. So this weekend was a good way of coming full circle in Taylor's career. Taylor finishes with 109 home runs, 21 of those coming in 2023 with the Kansas City Royals, a career single-season high for Taylor, and he finishes with 12.7 WAR, according to Baseball Reference. Taylor won a Gold Glove in 2021 and earned a World Series ring with the Washington Nationals in 2019. Here's Taylor explaining his decision to hang it up.
I love the game, but my family is my priority, so I think there's ways that I can stay in the game and still be there for my family. And, playing 162 is tough to do that. So, like I said, if there's another way for me to stay in the game and still be around, then I'd like to do that. With it being my last year, I think I couldn't have asked for a better group. It's a younger group, but these guys are really just good baseball players, even better guys, and I've enjoyed every second of it.
White Sox manager Will Venable was appreciative of having Taylor in the clubhouse in his first year with the White Sox.
It was amazing. We talked about it. He just was kind of the quiet leader, but I think he made his big impact on the entire group more than anybody. I mean, he made me better. He made the players better. He elevated everything that we did from the way that we communicated our meetings. He was the one that really took charge in kind of helping us define our non-negotiables and help hold guys accountable to that. He really like developed the fabric of our culture here, I'm gonna miss him, and just what a great guy who had a great career, and proud of him, and told him yesterday how proud we were to be part of his journey.
What's next for Taylor? He mentioned that one day he would like to be a coach, as he'll miss the people the most he's worked with stepping away from the game of baseball.
Top to bottom, I mean, whether it's front office players, media, people around the ballpark, you just come across so many good people, and we spend so much time together. It becomes like a family or fraternity, and I think I'll miss a good portion of that. And then also the game. I enjoy the process. I enjoy taking ground balls, fly balls, hitting the cage, all the little things that are done behind the scenes, along with going out there and playing in front of 30,000. So, to answer your question, everything. It's been my dream, and I've really enjoyed it. I'll miss it.
Venable likes the idea of Taylor being a future coach.
Do whatever he wants in this game. He's super bright, great communicator. He'd be a great coach. He'd be a great whatever he wants.
In Taylor's last game, he went 1-for-3 with a walk and an RBI, and finishes his 2025 season with the White Sox with 20 doubles, 9 home runs, and 35 RBIs in 134 games played. Our sixth year of Sox Machine Fantasy Baseball came to an end on Sunday in our first ever 32-team head-to-head league. We'd like to congratulate the 2025 champion, Big Herden. They beat the Stone Ponies in a wild back-and-forth championship game with a final score 6.5-3.5. They are the first ever rookie team to win the Sox Machine Fantasy League head-to-head title after finishing the regular season with the second best overall record. So congratulations to Big Herden. In our 15-team Roto League, the commissioner of all our leagues, Chris Kreb, and his team, Chuckles Garfine, took first place. The runners-up were Ducks Norton and Chicago Cheapskate. And in the 15-team Draft Champions League, our Set It and Forget It League, the winner was Gone in a Shriffin Minute followed by Vekas and Rec and Still Here. We plan to expand our offerings next season, including some very early Draft Champions leagues. We'll keep you posted here on the podcast and on SoxMachine.com. Thanks to everyone who participated this year. It was an incredibly fun season. Next on the Sox Machine podcast, Jim and I are going to dish out our 2025 awards. I think that there's going to be some repeats, Jim, but maybe we have some disagreements. There are three awards that we're giving out: our MVP, White Sox Pitcher of the Year, and Most Improved Player for the Chicago White Sox in 2025. Jim, let's start at the top. Who is your most valuable player for the Chicago White Sox in 2025?
It feels weird to say it, but I'm going to say Colson Montgomery. Not just because he led the team in wins above replacement, not just because like the power surge, but a huge lift to just the a few things that had plagued the White Sox over previous years, like problem solving, getting a player out of a huge rut. It did not cost Colson the season. Maybe cost him last season. But when he started off the year in a tailspin, they took a proactive approach to get him out of it. The way they talk about it sometimes makes me a little bit nervous, because like Jairo Iriarte had the same sabbatical that didn't quite work for him. It's not going to solve everything, taking guys out of the circulation and making them have to take a month off and play in a practice environment. But for Colson, it worked. And then like when he got to the majors, playing shortstop, like the whole idea that Venable and Getz preached about pre-pitch movement being important to defensive success. Yeah. When you look at him play shortstop, it looks like it shouldn't work, being 6'5" and not being especially fast, but he got the position he needed to be to make good throws, which I think is for him to stick at shortstop. That's what you want to see from him. Like, he'd have to make sensational plays. Just when he got to the glove on it, he seemed like he was in position to plant and throw. And that's good enough. So between him playing a shortstop and solving, at least for now, who plays shortstop for the 2026 White Sox, you maybe big picture of Billy Carlson matriculate smoothly is on a timetable where he and Montgomery is on the same roster. Like, Carlson easily kicks him off that position, but for the time being, he plays shortstop. And then, you know, he provides left-handed power, which White Sox have been seeking for so long, and providing that lineup balance is huge. Making opposing managers think about how they manage their bullpen is a lot more important, makes his lineup seem a lot more dangerous. And just seeing this hype, you know, that's been following him for years turn into something, you know, given just the warts on his profile and given the journey he took, being able to deliver on that hype, even if it was like a journey through the desert at one point, you just saw the lift it provided everybody. It provided the fans in the stands when he would hit a, you know, concourse challenging homer, when, you know, provided the broadcast for giving, you know, John Schriff and Steve Stone, you know, Brooke Fletcher, Connor McKnight, just a positive thing to rave about that did not seem forced. You know, as we've seen so many times the last few years, like whenever there was like a good storyline, they just milked the hell out of it. In this case, like having Montgomery buoy the offense and turn it into a real major league offense for stretches of the time, when they would speak positively about him or what the offense is doing, you'd think like, yeah, this is fun. I'm not second guessing their programming. I'm not overthinking it. Just like, it's a fun, they just did something fun. And now they're talking about how much fun that was. And this should be a more normal thing for following a baseball team versus like thinking like, are they trying to sell me on something that's not actually there? So that for those reasons, Montgomery's my MVP.
I agree with you. Montgomery is also the White Sox MVP. I could see some people want to make a case for Lenin Sosa because he led the team in home runs and in RBIs. But for the White Sox, especially post-All-Star break, the big boost that Montgomery provided. And to your point, Jim, we don't have to worry about who's playing shortstop next season. If you go back to our podcast episodes at the end of spring training, we are openly questioned, what in the world are the White Sox doing at shortstop? And that is a dangerous place to be, and it was for the White Sox. They only won 5 games in the entire month of April. Jacob Amaya is drowning out there at the shortstop position, and then Chase Mydroth gets called up, and he's got to play out of position. Mydrot did the best that he could, and he was better than average defensively at shortstop, but he doesn't have the throwing arm to play there every single day. To not have that worry is fantastic as far as roster building going to the 2026 season. I can already tell, Jim, Colson Montgomery might be one of the most divisive players that we're going to be previewing next season, in which we see the hope. We watched Colson Montgomery every game in the major leagues. Yeah, he's going to be a 310 on base percentage guy, but his 140 game pace, based on the numbers that he provided this year with the torpedo bat, he could be a 40 home run guy for the White Sox playing shortstop. But I think there's going to be, I'm not going to say a lot of negativity, but a lot of analysts on a national level that would disagree with us and say, Josh and Jim, Colson could really crater because the on-base percentage skills, the lack of contact skills, the high strikeout rate is going to have him crash. This might have just been a flash in the pan, and I think we're going to have those arguments going to next season.
You're going to say we're going to be talking about, you know, all the ways he's going to thrive, and then we talk to Keith Law.
Yeah, pretty much, maybe in February.
I'm thinking I need to book him for a two-part podcast, because I think we could just get lost in bantering about Montgomery back and forth and batting around his profile, and the all of the attributes and the red flags and having them go to war. We could just end up talking 38 minutes for a 40-minute segment about what Montgomery does. But no, he certainly splits fans and analysts. He also, I think, he splits probably analysts, just in terms of, like, the raw power is legit and in a way that was not described. Like, the homers he hit in Charlotte, you know, occasionally he'd get into one, but not in the way that he routinely got into one with the White Sox. Like, the, you know, maybe it's a case of Charlotte being so short to right field that, like, any homer that bounces onto Mint Street is like, oh, he hit that one 380 feet. Just cleared all the seats and kept rolling on concrete. And then you see him, you know, hit the same, you know, or hit what looks like the same ball in terms of, like, distance over the fence. And you realize, like, oh, that was 435 with 115 miles per hour off the bat. And that's not something you saw regularly. So he harnessed a power that had not been a part of his profile, and I think was part of the reason why, you know, scouts had to think that he would have to hit like 250 to get on base 350, because he's going to slug 450 or something like that. And ultimately be like a, you know, maybe plus power at the most, whereas like the power he showed was like plus. And that's different. So I'm, as we see top prospect list roll out and we see, well, actually he won't be on top prospect list, but as we see like reviews of prospects and we see, you know, season previews, especially from, yeah, you know, guys who talk about prospects who graduated, we see breakout lists, or we see, you know, dark horses, etc. He's gonna be something to watch, and yeah, I will have to tell Keith that if we talk about Colson, I'm gonna require an hour and a half from him rather than 45 minutes, just to make sure that we cover everything we need to cover.
So let us know in the comments section who is your guys' White Sox MVP. Moving over to best pitcher, Jim, I think that this probably is going to be unanimous again. For me, it's Shane Smith and the way that he pitched. And as we talked about at the beginning part of the show on how he finished this season, he goes 7-8 with a 3.81 ERA, 29 starts this year for the Chicago White Sox. But I really want to highlight what he did beginning of August and through September. 11 starts spanning 59 and two-thirds innings with a 3.17 ERA with 64 strikeouts and 21 walks. If that's the Shane Smith the White Sox are going to get going into next season, that's excellent. Like, this could be a 3-4 war type of starting pitcher. And, you know, just thinking aloud here, back to the point that you made early in the show, podcasting and recapping a 121 loss team, and it's like, man, are there any two war players on this team? And that's just the difference in a calendar year from 2024 to 2025. We're talking about legitimately our MVP choice, Colson Montgomery, could be a future four war shortstop or better, Jim. And Shane Smith has got a chance to be a four war pitcher or better after the White Sox had just traded away again another Cy Young finalist in Garrett Crochet.
Yeah, it's the easy choice for me. I will give an honorable mention to the other Rule 5 pick who stuck with the White Sox for the entire year. Mike Vassell, like, it's a case where I would give Vassell more consideration for pitcher of the year, given like the role he played out of the bullpen, given how many long days the White Sox had for the bullpen, but also like not just a mop-up guy or not just an innings eater in low leverage, but also save some games when, you know, when Venable is flying by the seat of his pants and just needing somebody to record three outs, he didn't mind turning to Vassell. And I think Vassell's personality, the whole Batman thing, just his, he seemed very, very open in terms of, for a rookie, he seemed very comfortable in his own skin and projecting his personality, which I think is good for a rookie and a reliever. Comfortable with those situations, even if he expressed nervousness after the game. He provided a lot of versatility out of the bullpen and helped win some games that maybe didn't look winnable. But the way Smith finished the season is just... The White Sox needed that for the rotation. Davis Martin's there. Everybody else, you know, question mark for Burke, as we talked about, question mark for Cannon. They're going to need to replace Martin Perez probably in some role. So having Smith not be a question mark, you know, he might not be entirely a fixture as far as like where he is as a major league pitcher. Is he a number three guy? Is he more of a number five guy? Can he stay healthy 2 years in a row? You know, valid questions, but he earned himself a spots in the rotation, no matter how his spring looks, to go into the first month of the season, see how he looks, see what questions he's been able to answer, see what new issues pop up and let him solve it there in major league games versus the other guys needing a little more to prove in terms of how efficient they can be, how many innings they can actually cover, how exposed they leave the bullpen. But going back to Vassell, I had to look it up while you're talking. Do you know the last pitcher for the White Sox to throw 100 innings while starting fewer than four games?
No idea. Is it recent?
Recent. It's pre-podcast. I'll give the year, 2010.
2010? Oh, man. No idea. Who in 2010?
Tony Pena.
Wow. How many innings did Tony pitch?
102 thirds, so barely cleared it. Had an ERA of 5.10. Like that's a case where like you know he was very much just a, you know, a low leverage guy who could just come in and eat innings.
Rubber
and
arm.
You don't care about what the game looks like. Yeah. My first guess was Keith Foulke because I remember him doing that as he emerged before he was like a closer. He was very much like a multi inning relief weapon with the changeup, and he threw like 105 good innings where he was a legit. If he were an all star that season, like he would have been a legit one because that was he earned a Cy Young vote for 105 innings of 2.22 ERA, struck out 123 batters. So I remember that season. I do not remember Tony Pena barely clearing the mark, but a fun trivia fact to annoy and astound your friends.
Well, that's great. Great find, Jim. And then finally, White Sox most improved player. This could be both on the position player side or on the pitching side. Who do you got, Jim? Who would get your most improved player award this year?
I'm not going to count Smith or Montgomery because, like, you can treat that as development versus improvement, you know, being that they went from prospects to the major leagues. Like, I would treat them as two different things. So I'm going to keep the improvement on the major league level. And I'm going to say Miguel Vargas. There are some other candidates for this, but I do think just in terms of how lost he was and how miserable or just, I guess you could just say vibes, I think is the most accurate term, just like they were not there and just in a tailspin personally and just kind of mechanically and nothing was working for him to being somebody who looked like he was worthy of being in a major league lineup for the entire season, somebody who could occasionally get into one, had the ability to tell balls from strikes all year that didn't abandon him, has the ability to play a third base that can start. Like there's still a big question mark. Like my hesitation in naming him most improved player is like, is he more than a second division starter or is he somebody who's better off being like a first, third DH, kind of getting in the mix, but not holding down one position? I think you'd like to see your most improved player meet that challenge. So I think that's my one hesitation of saying, like, that's why he's not quite there. But given just how, you know, in the Adam Dunn most improved player of just like how lost he was to how pleasing it was for him to be like, oh yeah, he's a major league hitter of some kind. Vargas gets the easy nod.
Yeah, this is unanimous for us on all three awards. Last year, Miguel Vargas was worth -1 WAR according to Fangraphs and had a 46 weighted runs created plus. In 2025, he was at 100 weighted runs created plus, so league average hitter, and was worth 1.3 WAR before the season finale. So that's a 2.3 WAR improvement from 2024 to 2025. Vargas led the White Sox in doubles, runs scored with 80, 56 walks, and he tied with Andrew Benintendi. This is not impressive, but you can say Miguel Vargas was a leader of the White Sox in triples hit with 2 this year. So leading the White Sox in doubles, triples, runs scored, and walks, along with his 16 homers and 60 RBIs. Much improved from 2024 for Miguel Vargas.
The one challenger I'll say, and it depends on if he qualifies, would be Adrian Hauser.
Oh, interesting.
Because okay. The year before with the Mets, he had a 5.84 ERA. And he threw like same amount of innings. So it rounds down, rounds up to 69 innings in both case. Goes to the Mets, 5.84 ERA. Baseball reference, negative 0.9 or 0.9 wins below replacement. Then goes the White Sox, same amount of innings, 2.10 ERA or 2.10 ERA, 3 wins above replacement. So you can make the case for him now, whether that, yeah, and you know, I'll offer him just so we have a difference in one area. So we're not unanimous on all three fronts, because like my question would be, it kind of amounted to Curtis Mead and you know, Duncan Davitt and Ben Peoples. And like, are they fixtures or a case where like he helped, you know, make the season more watchable, but did he have a lasting impact? You know, but then again, we're saying the same thing about Vargas. So I would say for the boost he provided, I'll say Adrian Hauser just to mix it up.
We're going to keep it Miguel Vargas. We're going to keep it unanimous. It makes it easier for me.
Nope. I'm changing my mind. Adrian Hauser, we differ in one area. Because Hauser was really cool. Like, that was a neat story as well. And you know, to speak to, like, ways the White Sox have maybe improved is they, you know, it seemed like an act of desperation to be just scouring other teams' AAA rosters. And, you know, they did a swing and miss with Miguel Castro trying to get like boost the bullpen by looking at like AAA Round Rock and going for him. And, you know, he had like 6 unimpressive games and then injured himself. But the fact that they were doing that and the fact that like it landed a legit gem in Hauser and just like, what would the season look like if he hadn't shown up? So yeah, I'm comfortable saying Hauser now that I thought about it, now that I realized like, he counts just as much as Vargas does. Adrian Hauser, most improved player.
All right. Me, it's still Miguel Vargas. But let us know in the comments section, who are your award winners for White Sox MVP, Pitcher of the Year, and Most Improved Player? We'll talk more and recap more about the White Sox 2025 season when we break down by the positions. Those episodes we're going to be not only recapping as far as all the players at that particular position group, but talk about what the future is for those position groups and maybe identify some targets in free agency to help out for your guys' offseason plan projects, which those will be open to start posting shortly after the World Series, which could be either in late October or early November. But with the postseason approaching for Major League Baseball, and we do now have the complete postseason picture, some way, somehow, the Cleveland Guardians won the American League Central, and they are the number 3 seed. The Detroit Tigers still made the postseason, so they don't have to be completely embarrassed like the New York Mets, who missed the postseason and were shut out 4-0 in game 162 down in Miami. So despite losing in Milwaukee, the Cincinnati Reds earn the 6th seed in the postseason. So the National League Central has 3 teams in the National League postseason, with the Milwaukee Brewers, the Chicago Cubs, and the Cincinnati Reds. We are notoriously awful with postseason predictions. Mm-hmm. So we're going to do our best. And we're going to start in the American League.
You know, just to follow up on our last podcast, talking about like tiebreakers and like how I wish there were game 163. I really wish there were game 163 now, because having all four teams, like four of the six teams, the Guardians, the Tigers, the Reds and Mets all losing, and the Reds getting in while losing, and the Guardians getting in while losing, or Guardians winning division while losing, it should be like, no, do it again. One team has to win in order to make this happen. Like you don't get to lose and back your way in with unimpressive records for the last playoff spot or the worst division winner. Make them earn it somehow, even if it's in direct competition. Like, so that bummed me out a little bit when you had these teams controlling their destiny, nobody doing it, but backing in anyway, a little bit of a sour taste. So let's see if that colors my approach to how I fill out my bracket here.
All right, so let's start in the American League. And we do have, as far as the TV times, so it looks like that it's going to be Detroit at Cleveland. That's going to be the first playoff game. The TV schedule for Tuesday, September 30th, first pitch of that game is going to be at 12:08 p.m. Central Time, and that's going to be on ESPN. Padres at Cubs, that's going to be 2:08 p.m. Central Time. That game will be on ABC. Red Sox at Yankees will be at 5:08. That will be on ESPN. And then Reds at Dodgers will be the late games. That's going to start at 8:08 Central Time on ESPN Tuesday and Wednesday. So let's start with that Cleveland and Detroit series. Best of three. Who do you like between the Tigers and Guardians?
I'm going to say Tigers just because it feels like a continuation of the regular season at this point, and it feels like Guardians were starting to cool off a little bit. Tigers, playing slightly better. I'm going to talk myself. I don't trust the Guardians bullpen, or Tigers bullpen, I should say. Short series, like, I still think their pitching staff's a mess. So I was trying to talk myself into regression, catching up to the Guardians, but I think the Tigers are still lost enough when it comes to trying to problem solve the last half of a game to where the Guardians can keep getting away with it for one more series. So I changed my mind mid-flight. We'll say Guardians.
I am with you. I also have the Guardians. If this series was in Detroit, I think I would pick the Tigers. But even though Tarik Skubal is going to be pitching in game one, that last outing for Skubal against the Guardians was not good. It got really weird. So I'm curious, maybe a motivated Skubal helps the Tigers win game one. But to your point, do the Tigers have answers in game two and three? I'm not sure. So I could see that series going three, but I do have the Guardians also winning and then moving on to Seattle. Boston at New York. I'm going to go with the Yankees to start. But this, I think this is a coin flip. I think the Red Sox could upset the Yankees at Yankee Stadium, but it seems offensively feasting on lesser competition, with the White Sox being part of that lesser competition, Jim. Suddenly this Yankees lineup is clicking, and even though I don't trust the bullpen for the New York Yankees, I like the Yankees offense more than Boston's offense. I could see this being a pretty high-scoring series, actually, between the Yankees and Red Sox. So I'm going to take the home team again. I'm going to go with the Yankees.
I'm going to go with the Red Sox just because I do like their – I think the pitching is, like, enough to win top to bottom, win a series, a short series especially. And then just the Red Sox won 9 of 13 games against the Yankees.
Yeah.
In the regular season, the Yankees seemed a little bit flustered by the Red Sox, whether that's a case where it actually happened or whether it's just like the media blowing it up to where, like, oh, they can't be their chief rival. This is a character flaw with the way these players are built and with the way Aaron Boone manages the team. So given that I feel like it's a coin flip, I'm going to say that the Red Sox just have enough to get by. And I'm hoping so, because I like watching Garrett Crochet. I want good things for Garrett Crochet in the postseason. So notching a win against the Yankees in an opening series would be a way to do that.
Lucas Giolito is going to be pretty key for the Red Sox if they're going to make a deep postseason run. So lots of old faces for White Sox fans. All right, so we both picked the Guardians. They would be going to Seattle in that third seed versus two seed. Who do you like between the Mariners and the Guardians?
Mariners. I think they, you know, just it all came together for them at the end in the way that I thought it would come together for them after the trade deadline they had in solving their biggest positions of need offensively. And just the Guardians, I feel, don't have enough for a team like the Mariners. I think like they are kind of a product of the AL Central and can win the AL Central. And we've seen that formula like hit a wall before. And I think the wall looks like Seattle shaped.
Yeah. So you got the Red Sox at Blue Jays. I have the Yankees at Blue Jays. I'm taking the Blue Jays. They have been incredible this year at home. And having home field advantage, I think this is going to be key for Toronto's run to the World Series, which is going to be a pretty surprising run. But I have the Blue Jays beating either the Yankees or the Red Sox in the Division Series and facing Seattle in the Championship Series. Do you have the same, Jim, or do you see the Red Sox upsetting the Blue Jays?
I see the Red Sox just because I've gotten burned by thinking the Blue Jays were going to be great before in the postseason. So I like the Blue Jays. Like, you know, it's a case where if they win, cool. Like, good for them. Like, I'm not invested in the series emotionally. I just want to see good baseball, interesting games. But I'm going to go with the Red Sox for one more series because I think we've seen the Red Sox do this before with having an offense, with having enough frontline pitching and like a way to make the late innings work to where I think they are stronger than maybe their record lets on.
All right. So then you have Mariners and Red Sox in the American League Championship Series. Who's your pick to win the American League pennant?
Seattle, because I want to see it.
Okay. You're willing it into existence. Like when you, I'm going to take Toronto.
Like when you saw Seattle clinch with the Cal Rally 59th and 60th homers, like I want to see that crowd for a lot of October.
All right. Well, you could. I have Toronto. Again, with the home field advantage, I think that's going to be key here. Even though Seattle offensively, and I think even on the starting pitching front, would have the advantage over the Blue Jays, that would be a great series. That would definitely go six or seven games. But I'm going to ride the hot hand with the home field advantage for Toronto to win the American League pennant. All right. Again, we are notoriously awful at this, so I apologize to both Toronto and Seattle. You guys are probably going to lose in the division series. Moving over to the National League, Reds, Dodgers. I don't know what to make of this one. Dodgers might want to be careful here because the magic of Terry Francona and Andrew Abbott and Hunter Green, they could steal a series with those two on the starting front. How are you feeling about Dodgers and Reds, Jim?
I feel like the Dodgers have enough of their starting rotation. Like they actually have their starting rotation intact for the postseason, which like never seems to be the case. Like it always seems like they're needing like some rando to start game three, if not game two for them. So for them to have like basically all their arms healthy for once, you know, their plan A's all like the bullpen's a mess. I think the late innings are a mystery for them, but I think the Cincinnati offense is so kind of unimpressive that I think the Dodgers having their starting pitching in place is enough to win the series. Yeah, you never predict a sweep, but I think like they'll look like the better team. It could blow up on. I think they're like one like terrible start away from their entire postseason being in disarray. So I think they're very volatile. But I think the Reds, like having watched their offense and watching them like try to win games like over this past month, like the Mets made them happen. And so yeah. I think like playing a formidable team that has everything lined up, like they're playing the Brewers, but the Brewers are just lining up everything for the postseason. And they had their seed locked up. They had home field locked up. I definitely think facing a team like the Dodgers that needs to win and has all their at least plan A's in place to win, I think is good enough for now.
Yeah. I have the Dodgers to win this short series. I think I could see the Reds, though, but I'll stick with the Dodgers. Moving over, Cubs and Padres. This is going to be a fun series at Wrigley Field. It's still warm in Chicago, so we could see some more high-scoring games. I like the Padres here. I don't know about like what the Cubs are going to do in the back end, and them losing Cade Horton for this series I think is a big blow. I got a lot of questions about the Cubs pitching, and you don't really want to have those questions against this type of potential from the San Diego Padres lineup. Fernando Tatis Jr. is red hot, and the Padres have a terrific bullpen. I think they have the right combination right now to make a deep run in the National League postseason. So I have the Padres upsetting the Cubs here. Who do you got, Jim?
I think the Padres as well. Like, I can kind of talk myself into the Cubs being good for at least one series. I think, yeah, the Horton injury might hurt them more the series goes on. I think it's probably more a matter of like, will their offense show up or not? And then, yeah, trying to figure out the bullpen as it goes is tricky. Like, they were, you know, looking at the record against 500 teams or teams 500 or better, the Cubs are 38-46. Padres held serve 43-43, which is kind of what you think, especially a wild card team, is going to be like fair okay against good teams and then beat up on the bad teams. Whereas the Cubs, I think, seemed to look stronger when the competition was weaker, and when they were pressed against a team with ambitions, could kind of look like the lesser team. So I think the Padres might have more going for them in the series to overpower them. But given that the Cubs, yeah, they can win some low scoring games. Like, they can, their starting pitching is still pretty solid. They can defend really well. So I think they can win low scoring games, but I think the Padres have enough to maybe make some games that look low scoring end up not being low scoring at the end.
So then we have Dodgers against Phillies in the division series. Who do you like in that matchup?
I think the Phillies. I think the Phillies have enough going for them offensively to where, like, if the Dodgers have to try to make a bullpen game work or have to cover six innings, like, I don't know how Dave Roberts is going to do it. So I will say the Phillies create enough chaos to make that happen.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the Phillies as well. Padres and Brewers. There's a part of me that's like, it's got to be the Brewers' year. Like, what a great story. State of Wisconsin's going to be rooting for Milwaukee. Do it for Bob Uecker. But again, I think the Padres have the formula to make a deep run this postseason. And we have been talking about it for so long with San Diego. If not now, when? And I think the when is here. And I have the Padres upsetting the Milwaukee Brewers in the division series and going to the National League Championship Series. Who do you got between Padres and Brewers, Jim?
I'm going to say Brewers just to disagree with you and to add some disagreement, because, like, I could go either way for the reasons you mentioned. Like, the Padres have a lot going for them. The Brewers, like, always seem like they're the sentimental pick always when it comes to the postseason. Like, teams that never haven't won one before. And then also small markets, smallest market team, being a team that can be a role model for so many other organizations in terms of how they solve problems over the course of a season, how they evaluate talent, how they occasionally spend when they can, how they stretch their budget to make players worth keeping stay with the organization. A lot of things going for them the way that you want other teams to emulate. The White Sox are among them. Yeah, the White Sox have a bigger market, of course, but like the way they're spending right now and the way that they want to try to get competitive, they're looking towards the Brewers. So I want to see that formula succeed. We've seen the kind of formula not succeed before in terms of not having the dominant starting pitching, the overpowering starting pitching, not having the overpowering bullpen in the traditional sense, not having like the truly incredible offensive forces. Their lineup can go quiet. So we've seen that, you know, they're lost to the Mets before. How devastating that was last year with Pete Alonso kind of crushing them, and you're seeing like this, the reactions on the field. You get that sense that could happen again, just because they are a darling for a reason. They're a darling for a reason because they don't have the traditional stars, and sometimes that hurts them. So I'm on guard against them having a short or a quick postseason exit again. But yeah, the Padres, you know, they are frustrating for their own reasons. So they're a team that's come up short time and time again because they, you know, have some issues. So two flawed teams or two teams that have a hard time getting over the hump. And I think this will represent a hump for them. I will say the Brewers to balance it out.
So in the National League Championship Series, you got Phillies and Brewers. Who's your pick to win the National League pennant?
I'll say Phillies, just because I think the Brewers can win one, but counting them to win two and set up my dream matchup of Mariners-Brewers in terms of one team is going to win their first, and one team's fan base is going to be thrilled, and I'm going to want to watch both stadiums to see how they react. That's what I want. That's what the heart wants. The head makes me think that's unlikely, so I'll say Phillies.
Okay. I mean, they'd be very much like 2016, right? Between the Cubs and, well, then the Indians, but now Guardians. Neither team had won in forever. For me, Padres and Phillies, if Zach Wheeler was still around, I would say Phillies have the edge, but he's not. So I'm going to pick the fifth seed in the National League coming out of the wild card to win the National League pennant. I have the San Diego Padres making the World Series and facing the Toronto Blue Jays. And I'll take it one step further. I'm picking the Padres to win the World Series over the Toronto Blue Jays. I have thought that the National League has been stronger than the American League. And we get to see Manny Machado win a World Series ring. Strike up all those wounds that we've had as White Sox fans. But I got Padres over Blue Jays in the World Series. Jim, who do you got between the Seattle Mariners and the Philadelphia Phillies?
Let's go Mariners. I will indulge myself, let myself have a little treat and predict the Mariners winning it all.
So we're both picking teams that have never won a World Series to win a World Series.
Yes. So, yeah, God willing. My question with the Padres, going back to it and thinking about, like, in terms of Garrett Crochet and looking forward to his postseason, equally interested, maybe not as like personally invested, but just fascinated by Dylan Cease's postseason. Or
he could be coming out of the bullpen.
Yeah. How are the Padres going to use him? What does he look like? What does that mean for his free agency? And we talked about it before, like what his free agency is going to look like. That could, you know, a successful postseason or an unimpressive one could really color it in terms of what teams think this guy really is. So I want to see Dylan Cease, and then, like, no reason to hold it against him, but just far enough removed away from him being like a great White Sox pitcher versus having seen Garrett Crochet, like his last experience with the White Sox being somebody who's just getting better and better. Curious about Dylan Cease.
Yes. Well, we'll see how the postseason goes. Again, the wild card round is Tuesday through Thursday. And we'll have our next podcast. We'll be recapping what happened in the wildcard round and also preview the upcoming division round. We got the end of the year Sporacle coming up as well. That's going to be a fun video trying to guess all of the players that played for the White Sox in the 2025 season. So you can laugh at us and how poorly that we do, especially for people who cover this team daily. We're not going to get 100%, but we're going to do our best to try to get everyone, and can't wait to see what your guys' results are as well. So that's the week ahead to look forward to at Sox Machine. And also plug, James Fegan did sit down with Will Venable on a one-on-one, so we have some exclusive interview coming up with the White Sox manager that you could look forward to on SoxMachine.com. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen and watch the show on our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine, including Instagram, as we're trying to build up our base there. So if you are on the gram, follow us over there at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you enjoy our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, sign up to become a Sox Machine supporter at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5. That gets you the ad-free version of both the podcast and the website. And we also have additional tiers of support as well with additional benefits.
Yeah, and we will be running a be on the lookout for a postseason or offseason sale. We always get a whole bunch of subscribers at the start of the year, spring training, et cetera. But it always helps the Sox Machine budget to spread that out. So in the event of we have some people on the fence of subscribing, we'll be running a sale for the first week of the off season, an extra month free on an annual plan. So be on the lookout for that once the White Sox off season officially commences on Monday.
Well, there you go. How about that? So if you're not a supporter, no better time than now to sign up. So again, go to SoxMachine.com/products to sign up for a Sox Machine subscription. Again, both annual and monthly subscriptions are available. We do have a couple spots open as well in our Veterans Committee if you would like to be part of our group chat and part of our monthly Zoom calls when we share our upcoming plans, especially with the 2026 season. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.